This episode of How to Save the World is sponsored by All Heart NZ, a registered charity dedicated to reducing, reusing, and redirecting corporate waste to help both the planet and Kiwi communities in need. Learn more about the amazing work they do at allheartnz.org.nz.
Welcome to another exciting episode of How to Save the World. No Waveney this week. I'm Tim, and I'm joined by guest co-host, beloved New Zealander, recent recipient of the New Zealand Order of Merit, I understand.
Yes, well, I haven't received it yet. I got a mini one sent in the post that I can wear to yoga, but
it's Robin Malcolm.
Hello.
Hey. Hello. You've got a little mini one.
I've got a mini one, and then on the 20th of September I go and get my big one.
That is so cool.
I know, I'm very excited. I'm not quite as excited as my mother. My mother's really excited.
That's sweet.
Yeah.
You got it for your services to acting and screening on the stage.
Is that right? I'm imagining so. I'm hoping maybe it might also be for being a bit of a good citizen every now and then, but
yeah.
I might be pushing it a little bit. I've got a little bit of imposter syndrome about it. I'm like,
everyone does.
I'm just this funny actress. Why are they? You know. But then I keep meeting, you know, people from my industry in the supermarket who say things like, get the fuck over yourself and just take it for us. You know, like all the people in the arts, we need as much.
Well, yes,
you know,
that's absolutely
and,
true.
And I do, and I'm not being disingenuous or ungrateful about it. I'm really grateful, but yeah, it's weird.
You also, I don't think you should feel it's unearned. So I know that everyone has imposter syndrome. That's the one thing I've learned hanging out with, going to America and elbowing with like semi-famous comedians and actors and stuff over there and really cool famous people from here. No one feels like they
belong.
Deserve to be where they are at.
No,
which
no.
Which is so weird. But you've got like this extensive history of activism. Of putting your neck out there, both in the acting world, like people will be, I'm sure, familiar with all the stuff around The Hobbit and
yep.
all the union stuff that went on there. But you have for over a decade been advocating for New Zealand's green spaces and species,
yep.
and you are a true environmentalist.
I've been doing it for, the first protest march I went on was when I was 16. And it was the year that wasn't an environmental thing, but it was the year of the Springbok tour. And I went out and protest against that. And I got hit in the head with a clod of dirt. And it made me think, right, I'm going to do this again.
Awesome.
this gets a response. And then there was a lot of, you know, the anti-nuclear stuff in the late 80s. So I was involved with that. And I was involved in an anti-vivisection sort of animal rights thing for a long time. I think I grew up, both my parents were very political, I guess.
Right.
And the conversations around the dining room table were always about something, you know. And I always used to, I used to slam my fist on the dining room table and get really angry when they would tell me to be reasonable or whatever, you know. And, you know, as teenagers do. So I've always associated getting involved with stuff as kind of just being a good citizen.
Yeah.
You know, and also it's important to constantly remember that we live in a democracy and it's our God-given right to get up and say what we think.
Mm.
I'm looking across at the UK right now in terror going, oh my God, what's happening to democracy in the world? When you look at the US and the UK and the way that's being strangled right now by both of those knobby leaders, it's frightening.
I think there's been possibly a little bit of complacency because we didn't have a world war for a little while and everyone forgot that all of these structures that we put in place are there for a reason and we just kind of took certain things for granted.
That's right. The structures and the institutions kind of protect us and they need to. And I've never quite understood why voting is not compulsory the way it is in Australia. I think it should be, you know, because people do get apathetic and they do take democracy for granted and they do take the fact that they are able to make a choice for granted, which I think is dangerous.
I've been having or seeing some interesting conversations and had one or two with Chloe Swarbrick, a very prominent Green Party MP,
yeah,
about her considering out loud, which is possibly a little politically naive, whether she would be doing more good inside of Parliament, especially with respect to things like climate change and the environment, or working from the outside trying to put pressure on politicians. Because I think there has been a lot of hope with this new left government that we've got, the Labour-led government in New Zealand, and perhaps a little bit of inertia and people feeling a little burned that more hasn't happened quicker, particularly around the environment. And do you have a take on that as sort of a person who has been on the outside pushing in for so long about what's effective and what people can actually do that
well,
gets
I think
a bit of change done?
I think ultimately things change with a vote, right? So, and politics now is driven so much by the fear of the vote next year or the year after. You know, how can we ensure that we stay in? Which means that you straddle a middle ground and not a lot gets done because of fear, which is really frustrating. And it seems to be something that's kind of more prevalent now than it was. You know, I think we have a breed of sort of fearful career politicians. I don't think the Labour government is that. I know a number of those people, and I think that their values are, you know, they line up with mine, and I think their visions for the future are great, but they're up against some pretty strong opposition in there. If there was a, you know, like a mandate from the will of the people, everybody, to change something, then I don't think they'd have a choice, you know. So it's obviously a complex mix of the two, which is not a cop-out answer, but I think the more pressure you put on from the outside, the better. But also, if you are able to stand being in Parliament, if you're able to stand being inside the beehive and work from the inside, I'm sure that's where the significant changes, happen. I mean, I've been in situations before where, you know, we've been protesting for something or advocating for something or protesting, and you meet the MP and you meet the person who agrees with you, and you know they've got to take that back into the building and deal with someone who believes the complete opposite to them, which I guess is the good thing about
that's
MMP.
Democracy. Yeah,
and
it's called a House of Representatives.
It's called a House of Representatives, that's right. And that means that change is really slow. The problem at the moment is with climate change is that we can't afford for change to be really slow anymore.
Yeah.
We just can't.
I was talking to someone recently that I think probably what's required is for a political party to be called "We're Out of Fucking Time."
Yeah, we're fucked unless we do something. Party.
Yeah, like now or like yesterday.
Yeah, you know? Do something.
I've because I I'm in my early 30s now.
Yeah,
and I've always been.
So am I, bro.
Always been. What an amazing career you've had in your early 30s,
To have fitted all that in by the time I was 32, it's great.
Incredible, Ron.
Yeah.
So I have always been a pretty politically minded person and previously quite hopeful. And this is a semi-embarrassing story, but the day that Trump got elected, because I'm like semi-obsessed with American politics. It's kind of this hobby that I follow.
Yeah.
It's my version of sport because I'm a skinny dude who has no aptitude. So I follow that instead. And
what sport would it be like though, American politics?
If
politics were to be a sport, what would it be?
Chess boxing. Have you seen that?
Chess boxing.
They have a round of chess and then they get in a boxing ring and beat the shit out of each
other. Yeah, that sounds right.
It's that.
Yep.
That's the closest thing. And on the day, because it was such a foregone conclusion that Hillary Clinton was going to win, and watching the results roll in real time, like I'll never forget that day as long as I live. And I went pescatarian that day from being a massive meat eater. And then this year I've actually gone vegan as well. And it's,
wow.
And the thought process behind it has honestly just been, I give up on politics. Like, I don't, like it's not going to work. Rufus has come in, my little dog, and
Hi,
joined
Rufus.
Us.
Is Rufus a vegan too?
No.
He's not.
Absolutely not. No.
Well,
I think that would be cruel.
Maybe put him through some reruns of the American election and see what happens.
See what he
does. Do you know what?
It's up to him.
I was on a plane from Los Angeles to New York the night of the election, and I left Los Angeles just as they were starting to count the votes. I arrived in New York when they just announced who the next leader. And honestly, it was like I'd walked into the biggest funeral in the world. It was just quiet.
And you were in her country, but like in New York City, you were in her ground as well.
Yeah. She was a senator and his. I mean, the great thing was that I ended up being part of the protest outside Trump Towers the week later or whatever, but it was the most extraordinary thing, feeling this plane as we flew across the country, the kind of the no. And then quiet, and then we all got off the plane, and it was like there was almost no life in that city.
Even here in New Zealand, I swear you could feel it walking around. Everyone was just like, what the holy heck has just happened?
And you know what? There's a part of me that just thinks, guys, you know, I mean, I know there's, you know, like I watch all those news channels and they have all those, it's because they can't afford to send a journalist out in the field anymore. So they have those, you know, the CNNs and all the rest of it. And they all sit around and they discuss stuff. You know, they have all their experts come in and they all wring their hands and they, you know, and I just think, fuck you guys, you know, fuck you. You voted him in and you vote to keep guns in and you wring your hands in the news and nothing happens. Do something.
So this is why I think, and I am constantly trying to find what the vehicle is. And I guess it was almost a birth of this podcast in a way as well. It's like, hey, guess what? No one else is going to do this for us, and we're completely out of time for politics to do this.
Yeah.
So we actually all need to start and making action and convincing people.
Yeah, and but politics has to do it. Like the only way to really change stuff, the only way to change it to the degree that it needs, is legislation. It has to be that. You know, I mean, we've been, you know, we've all been recycling for years. We've all been riding bicycles for years. We've all been trying to lower our carbon footprint. And I say that, and I know I'm the biggest hypocrite in the world because I jump on planes to work, you know. But we all try. Somehow we all try. And we're still going downhill fast, you know, without a brake pad. And I think the only way significant stuff is going to – the only way we're going to turn this around is through solid legislation. And the problem with it is that there's that belief, and I remember listening to podcasts and TED Talks, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and the angle was dealing with climate change is never going to work because there's no bang for your buck economically. That's why they don't, you know, it's because there's no way to make money out of it. I don't know whether that's still true, but I believe that. I believe that's why nothing's been done, is because money comes ahead of everything. And so when you say to people, this is going to cost, it's actually going to cost. It's going to cost you your second car, or you're just going to have to pay a bit more tax, or people don't want to do it because we're naturally so short-sighted, probably because we only ever live for 80 years. And, you know, when I listen to my beautiful niece Sylvie, who spoke at Ollie Langridge's 100th day outside Parliament last week, and she also came and spoke with me when we were doing this thing for the Hector's Dolphin, and she said this great thing. She just said, you know, it was all about you're leaving it in our hands. I'm 11 and I'm worried because you guys haven't done anything. You're leaving it up to us. And I think that's a kind of a symptom of how short-sighted we are. It's like, oh, well, that's all right, because I'll be dead in 30 years and then someone else can deal with it. And I don't know what the answer is to that it's hard to motivate people.
Got it, because that's why I got you on.
Yeah, well, it's hard. It's really hard to motivate people when they know it's going to cost them. I believe you can do it, and I believe it's got to be about positive change, not about loss, but actually this is going to make life better. I also believe that people feel great when they're doing something they know is good.
I'm sure this will be something that gets diagnosed soon, if it hasn't already been added to the, what is it called, the DSM, the big manual of disorders, mental things that can be diagnosed, of like eco-anxiety. I've got so many mates my age and a little bit younger who are like, you know, legitimately so paralyzed and stressed out and catastrophizing all the time about this stuff.
I'm not surprised.
And one thing that when Waveney and I have both talked with each other and had guests on, that keeps coming back is just taking some sort of action is such a big help for yeah. that. Just doing something, just making some sort of change.
Yeah.
And yeah. there is a big snowball effect as well, because I have to admit, I hope that this changes, but my outlook is way more cynical than yours about the role of government and politics now. Mm. I just think it's like we almost have to circumvent them somehow.
Have and a revolution.
Waveney's really big on sort of consumer choice and really empowering people to vote yes. with their wallets.
Yes.
And every single dollar that we yeah. spend, you know, is a vote.
Yeah.
Every single product and economic activity that we do is voting yeah. for something. So it's yeah, it's a tricky one to try and find the answer, but I reckon we've kind of got to go around.
And that the no, a little bit. Well, hopefully it can be both, because I mean, if as a nation we all tell the government that we want this,
how do you
then
think
they got to do it?
Because you spoke earlier about a public mandate. What sort of form do you think that takes? Like, what does that look like? Is that petitions? Is it change.org? People signing up on that? Is it people marching to the streets, to Parliament?
I think you find something specific. I think it's hard when it's general. Fix climate change. You got to find something really specific. Like there was an action that I was involved in a few years ago, which was about stopping the mining of the open cast mining along the west coast of the South Island. And we got Lucy Lawless and I got involved in a really small way.
That was the national park, right?
Yeah, it was the national park.
Key government from doing the big mining there.
Yeah, yeah. And we made this, Lucy and I made this little video called Sexy Coal, because we had found this footage of Jerry Brownlee using the phrase sexy coal. And because it was comedic, it got out there. And it did the rounds, apparently in his office. It got so many hits. They were just watching. And the movement grew. And it was sort of a combo of the fact that comedy reached a lot more people. But we suddenly threw ourselves into it, along with Greenpeace, and 40,000 people marched up Queen Street. And we got it stopped. And it was, that works.
Yeah.
But it was specific.
Yeah.
And we targeted something that people really care about.
That's
and,
good.
And I also thought, I think laughter helped.
Yeah.
You know, because sometimes it gets a bit scary. You know, one of my nieces was, she wanted to go on the school strikes for climate. And apparently other parents in this particular school wouldn't let their kids go because, what was the quote? The quote was something like, those kinds of marginal marches, they can get a bit violent. You know, like there's still, there's still that perception out there that if you go on a march, if you're publicly active, whatever, then you're a bit aggressive and a bit of a loon, and you're going to, you know, get beaten up by
that's
a cop. Or, I know.
Almost a throwback to the Springbok stuff,
that's
isn't it?
That's right. I think it is. It's like people's terror of unions.
Mm.
You know, it becomes really reductive to sort of a negative place. So, I mean, I agree with Wave. I think, and my boys and I was showing them the Leo DiCaprio doco the other day, and God bless them. It was a small thing, but at the end of it, they both went, wow, not going to buy any more Doritos. And I was like, yeah.
That's awesome. That's an action. That's specific.
Yeah, we're going to go. And then they said, have we got anything in the house that's got palm oil in it, Mum? And I was like, shit, no. And they were like, good, 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 good. You know, and it just, that was a little turn for them, whereas yeah. sometimes when I bang on about it, you see their eyes roll into the back of their head because it's too big.
That's such good. I haven't heard this talked about much before at all, so the specificity is really key.
I honestly think that's it. I mean, if you're somebody like, say, Greta Thunberg, who talked so openly about how she was heading down a pretty dark road in her life, and then she found that there was something that she could do with that, and now she feels like really, you know, like she's active and she's countering all her anxiety with action. There's that, but I think most people, you know, most people have got lives
yeah.
that they kind of want to get on with.
Go
and,
about.
And they've got worries that happen on a daily basis. You know, the kids are sick. Can I pay my phone bill? My car's broken down. Am I getting a, you know, am I going to get made redundant? Am I not? I hate my job. I want to, you know, like we've all got that life stuff going on. And then when there's a big thing that comes over that says the world's going to hell in a handbasket unless you do something, it's like, what? I'm just going to run around in my house and panic. You know, whereas if someone, if there was a, listen, what you can actually do to help is just don't buy food with palm oil in it, for instance. I haven't got time. I haven't got time to go through the supermarket and look at everything that's got palm oil in it. Okay.
Here's some brands that are, you can trust.
Here's some brands that are good. Yeah. Can we lobby the supermarket so that they can market like they do free range? For, you know, like if you look at the journey of, I've done a lot with Safe over the years. And if you look at, you know, the number of people now that will actively choose free range over non-free range, you know, eggs and chicken and pork, it's really grown and it's labelled.
Yeah.
So it's easy. You know, it's
because people do want to do the right thing, eh?
I think that's the thing. I think people do, but sometimes doing the right thing seems like really serious and too hard.
Yeah.
So making it specific, but also
Finding the joy in it.
Finding the joy in it. Absolutely. I mean, I remember years ago, the international head of Greenpeace, this guy Kumi Naidu, came over and he spoke at a pub in Kingsland, and I went along to hear him. And there's a lot of the problem with all of this is there's a lot of should. We should be doing this. We should be doing that. We should be, you should. And what comes alongside with that is, and you're not doing it. So we're all wrong. We're always wrong because we're not doing the right thing. And that's why the plan. So there's a lot of bad feeling. There's a lot of shame. There's a lot of panic. There's a lot of anxiety. And so I said to him towards the end, I said, we get all of this. How do you actually motivate people? How do you do it? Because it's not working yet. There aren't enough of us who care yet. There aren't enough of us who care to the extent that we want to change our lives for it. So how do you make that happen? And he didn't really have an answer back then, or not one that I remembered. Interestingly, last week I spoke to Ollie Langridge outside the Beehive, and somebody from the Extinction Rebellion, I asked them the same question, and they said it's about positive change. It's about finding a way to convince people that these choices will make their lives better and will also make them feel great.
I guess
I haven't quite worked out the magic formula for that.
That seems so intuitive, right?
It
because
does.
Because humans will do the thing that makes them feel good.
Yeah.
So if you can kind of tie that to the thing that will make the planet feel good as well, then
yeah.
There you go. There's your
yeah.
solution to it.
As opposed to something that's fearful. Oh, if we
yeah.
don't do this, we're all going to, you know, burn.
I think the YouTube algorithm has figured out that I'm a big fan of Greta Thunberg. So it throws all these videos
right,
at me.
Right.
But it's also, it knows that I am realizes I'm a white male in my early 30s. So it's throwing me all of these weird, like, conservative takes on her as well. And I just, the vitriol that it has been thrown at this hero. Like, I really think
she's a hero
of our time, truly is. And the common criticism seems to speak to what you're talking about. People are going, you know, don't you wag your finger at me. Don't tell me what I can and can't do, you 16-year-old sort of thing. These predominantly guys with these fragile egos who couldn't listen to anyone, you know, who's not 50 like they are, even when they're speaking the truth and they're scientifically backed. But I think, because my inclination is, because of the size of the problem that we're facing, is just to go, what the fuck? Like, I don't think we should meet you on the terms of, you know, having to sort of cede ground to be positive and get in behind the train rather than stand in front of it and go, you're about to fucking fall off a bridge.
Yeah.
But I guess you have to, don't you? Because the other ways just aren't impactful and effective.
Well, unless you legislate against the white 50-year-old men who don't believe that climate change is happening. If there's a way of
Which feels very tricky and dangerous as well.
Yeah, because they vote, you know, there's money, you know, you follow the money in politics always, right?
Let's take it back to something. Let's take it back to something specific. So you've got this 11-year-old niece. Sorry, what's her name again?
Sylvie.
Sylvie. Yeah. And so I think I read somewhere that Sylvie was one of the reasons, or you got involved with Sylvie for the recent campaign to protect the Hectares dolphin.
Yeah, well, she was going down a similar road. I mean, she, you know, I've talked to her mum, you know, my sis, and she would say Sylvie's just, she's obsessed with it. She's so worried and feels overwhelmed because at 11 she doesn't have a vote and she doesn't know what to do, and she's in a school, for instance, they don't recycle yet, you know. Wadestown Primary, recycle.
Looking
for
at you,
goodness sake,
you guys can afford you. It I'm sure it's a decile 10.
You can
10.
Fucking afford it. Jesus Christ. I introduced Sylvie over Christmas to Liz Sluton, who's one of the two professors out of Dunedin University. And her and her partner, Steve Dawson, pretty much have been the two people that have kept Hector and Maui dolphin alive for the last 30 years. If it wasn't,
how many Hectares dolphins do we have left?
Oh, I think there's about 10,000, but there's only 53, 56 Maui left.
Wow.
Only, I mean, we're down to black robin territory with them, you know. And these two, their work has stopped them, both of them, from becoming extinct. Anyway, they work in and around Akaroa over the summer, and I go down there and stay with my sister and her fella and her husband and their three boys. And she said, I told her about Sylvie, and she said, bring Sylvie out on the boat, on our research boat, and we'll go out and we'll find some. So I took Sylvie out there, and she saw these dolphin. And so and it just made her feel great to be around someone who was doing something specific.
Yeah.
That was really helping, you know. And so then when Greenpeace contacted me a month or so ago and said that there was these submissions are being put to Parliament, and did I want to help with that and get behind that, I was like, Sylve needs to come with me on this journey. And it was great. It was great. She, you know, she wouldn't let her parents read her speeches. She did it all herself. And I know that it made a big difference to her because she felt like she was actually somehow contributing, because we really like contributing. There's that, I can't remember where I read it, you know, that everyone's writing books and essays and opinion pieces on happiness. And one of the common denominators with all of these is that the happiest people on the planet are people who do stuff for other people.
Yeah.
Or do, you know, so
those selfless acts of service to others in a community. Is,
It's
a total universal that cuts across the whole globe.
Exactly. Yeah. So all of this is about that. And if we could kind of harness that somehow, I mean, I don't know about your greedy, wealthy businessmen who don't give a fuck. I don't know about them. I don't know what drives them. To me, it's like everything's rushing towards the same conclusion, is that, you know, the way capitalism is driving the West, and the way that has been, you know, money's the new god. It doesn't surprise me that the planet is where it is. You know, it's like that, be careful of what you want because you'll get it. You know, if what you want's money at all other costs, then yeah, you'll get it. You won't have a planet anymore, and you may not have that many friends, but you'll have money, you know. And to me, for us to be dealing with climate change, extinction of most of the animals on the planet, somehow looking after the 7 billion people on the planet, you know, over half are not doing well on the poverty scale, we need to kind of rethink who we are as human beings, because we're driven by fear mostly.
This episode of How to Save the World is sponsored by All Heart NZ, the charitable trust helping Kiwi corporates be more responsible with their stuff.
All Heart NZ are providing tools and expert advice to support businesses to improve their sustainability and social good, and not just in New Zealand.
By providing expert support services and tech solutions, they're helping tackle huge international problems like modern slavery embedded in global supply chains. Thank goodness for All Heart NZ. You can learn more at allheartnz.org.nz.
I read a book years ago. In fact, my father put me onto it. He started a lobby group, an online lobby group that's been running for a while now called Closing the Gap, which is about pay equity. And there was a book that was maybe 20 years old now called The Spirit Level, and it was about that, and it looked at the gap between the rich and the poor, not how rich people were or how poor people were, but the gap. And then it measured that gap against about 100 various social indicators like happiness, depression, suicide, health, teenage pregnancy, crime, violence, all of those things. And it concluded, just with data, that the smaller that gap was between the rich and the poor, the lower all those negative social indicators were. Basically saying, I think the Financial Times reviewed this book and said, we really, really don't like books like this and what they're saying, but we can't argue with data because it's just data. And it was basically saying that equal societies where people pretty much earn kind of on a par with each other, and there's not that much competition, they're just happier across the board. And the analogy was, if you walk out your front door and you know that your neighbor up the street is worth, you know, 100 times more than you are, millionaire, and the person who lives in the little house down the end of the street is practically homeless, your relationship with the world is going to be completely different than if you walk out of your house and you just know that everyone's pretty much on an equity. You know, like it's softer, and it means that your priorities become different. You know, they're not about beep beep. You know, I've got to haul myself out of the gutter and get myself up to where that guy is.
It's that hierarchy of needs thing, isn't it? It's like know that you can go to the doctor when you need to, and you can buy food for your kids and get them to school, and everyone's looked after. You can look a little further afield and go,
yeah,
can I get the free range eggs instead of the super cheap battery ones? Yeah. Can I get organic chicken?
Because the whole community's thinking like that.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember speaking to, I hung out with a couple of filmmakers from Denmark for a while, and, you know, they've got a very sort of egalitarian society over there. And I said, how is that? And he went, well, he said, it's a little boring because we've all pretty much got the same sort of furniture. I went, right. And he said, but the furniture's lovely. And he said, but actually, I love the softness of my country. There's it doesn't have that same edge. I mean, the interesting thing is, of course, countries like America, all those negative social indicators are off the chart because of the very, very rich and the very, very poor, you know. And so that, we've got to deal with that as well.
I totally agree. I think it's so part and parcel of fixing all the other bigger problems.
Yeah, I mean, where we've ended up today, I guess, is it started with the Industrial Revolution, didn't it?
Mm.
And it started with, and that kind of bred that new form of capitalism. And so there's a very small number of people, very, very wealthy people, that are driving the destruction of this planet. And unless we harness that, unless we stop that, I don't know what we do.
Speaking about those sort of big zoomed out picture things, so you were no fan of the Key government, I think, that we had for 9 years on the whole.
No, I wasn't.
And you were a voice in the lead up to the election to try and get the government that we've got in now.
Yeah.
On environmental stuff, how do you think this Labor-led coalition government is going in New Zealand?
I don't think they're going anywhere. I don't think they're going as far as they need to by a long shot, but I also understand that they're up against some pretty hefty opposition behind those doors. I believe that they are trying a lot, you know, like the, well, for instance, that we all thought that a capital gains tax would happen under this government and it didn't. I believe that that's not because they didn't want it, you know, and I'm fairly sure that it would be it's the same with a lot of the environmental stuff.
Where are we for? So I, for reference, in the lead up to the last election, hosted a TV show where I had panel guests and stuff each week, so I had to pay really close attention to the news.
Right.
As soon as I stopped doing it, I tapped out.
Right.
I got so over it. So I just have been so tuned out of political news pretty much since it happened, which is very bad. But do you know, have you sort of been paying attention, where is our current government doing well, and where do they maybe need our support to have a public mandate, or where do they need to improve quickly, big time, with environmental stuff?
Well, I think I think what Ollie Langridge is doing outside the Beehive is good. I mean,
tell us about him. What's
well, he's been protesting. He's basically camped outside the Beehive for 100 days on the trot, basically to, yeah, and he said he would stay there until the government declared New Zealand, that New Zealand had a climate emergency, because then under a climate emergency you can do a lot more stuff. And I agree with him. I don't see why we shouldn't be now, because we're in an emergency.
Mm.
You know,
a majority of our councils have done it now.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
The local government level.
So why we wouldn't do it nationally is, well, I mean, I guess it's such a big call. Maybe they're fearful of it. I don't know. One of the big ones for us environmentally is the waterways. And this, you know, and of course the farming industry is, they're a huge, you know, there's a huge pushback.
Yeah.
And I don't know that they've done much with that yet.
There is a, speaking about all the money tied up with this and how it's stopping it, I mean, that's the whole problem, I think, in New Zealand, with a big farming conglomerate, Fonterra, just stopping anything from changing. We had Dr. Mike Joy on the show, who's an expert in water ecology in New Zealand. And, like, man, he painted a pretty bleak picture.
Oh, well, it is.
And he's been
bleak.
Fighting for so long to try and get change, and he's just, you know, audibly had enough. he's over it.
And one of the big things we could do is, you know, we got to move away from dairy and beef.
Yeah.
We have to. And I know that's not our history. I know what this country was built on, blah, blah, blah. But we just have to.
Yeah.
Because it's lethal. You know, that's an international thing.
He also made a good point that these little specific things these farms could be doing, which kind of wouldn't have any downside to them. Like, we're farming really intensively, but he was saying that there's all this evidence based on overseas studies where they've had less intensive farming and they get just as much yield in terms of milk products out of the cows with 20% less cows. And that you can drop your, I think, like, total nitrate, I'm going to misquote him slightly, but all of the sort of petroleum products that you've got to use by like 50%, because it's not this linear scale. It's when you start really.
And is that because
in,
the cows are happier and fatter and produce more? And
it's also to do with, I think, how much you're destroying the topsoil and like how much those sorts of environments can actually soak in, because it will kind of get to a point of maximum saturation and then all the ecology will break down. The whole farming system breaks down because the grass can't cope with the amount of Roundup you're putting on it anymore to stop, you know, with the pesticides and that, in addition to all the fertilizer to make it grow. And it's like there's a maximum amount you can use of that stuff. And I think the problem in New Zealand is we just want, you know, more cows, more milk, more exports, more for GDP.
It's the same with the fishing industry, right? You know, it's like dial back the greed on all of this and the yield could be, you know, like
it doesn't have to be this zero sum, you're going to miss out thing if you can take a slightly more global view and have a look at some other practices.
That's right. And I mean, I know that I am, you know, economically naive. I'm not a politician, I'm not a scientist, I'm not an economist, but I look at every year the word that disturbs me more than anything in our newspapers is growth. More growth, more growth, more growth, more growth. I'm like, why do we need more growth? Why do we need more growth? Because the more growth we have, it's not like the poor people, the people below the poverty line get any better off. It's not that. It's about a redistribution of wealth. It's about fixing, you know, we don't.
Now you're talking like a socialist.
Oh, well, yeah. You know, control the production. What is it? Control the production.
Seize the means of production, absolutely.
Yeah. Is that we don't need more growth. We really don't.
Yeah.
Our televisions are the size of our houses. We need redistribution and we need community again. You know, we need to, a bit more of the gift culture. We need to reduce a little bit. I mean, that's what households are trying to do. You know, you're trying to reduce your carbon footprint. You're trying to reduce the amount of hot water you're using on a daily basis. You're trying to reduce your, you know, your electricity bill. You're trying to reduce your amount of waste, you know. So
A good point.
How about we do that on the national scale?
I hadn't thought about it in those terms, but I think you're super right. Most people, and maybe I'm just living in a little green bubble, but most people, it seems these days, really are trying to make some effort to reduce their stuff. Companies will never do it unless you legislate and tell them to, because they have to chase the money. Within the law. So you've just got to change the law to make them do it too, because we're doing it. So why shouldn't this other part of society
do it too? I go on film sets now, for instance, and if plastic cups turn up on film sets, they get told off quick. You know, it's become much more part of our it's not extremist behavior anymore. It's part of our lexicon. It's part of our our common knowledge. But we're doing it on a personal level when in fact we need to be doing it on a net. I mean, the fact that it took us so long to get plastic bags out of supermarkets is hilarious. Well, it's not hilarious, it's awful. It's awful. We were 10 years or more after the UK. And for what? Why?
Yeah.
Why? But also, you go into supermarkets now, and of course, there aren't the plastic bags to carry your food out, but there's a shitload of plastic in there anyway.
Yeah, totally.
You know,
It's a stepping process, isn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, here we are. We're going round and round and round and round and round and round in circles, talking about pretty much every aspect of life and how it is overwhelming. So my answer to it is schools. You know, the more you don't want to educate kids to panic them, but I think it's necessary to educate them. You know, it's good to know the cold hard facts, but also to know that there are things being done and that there are people who are already working hard and that they can do something too. I mean, I really believe, I read an opinion piece in The Guardian that was written by a New Zealand woman. She was I think she was the head of a nanny group here, and it was a sort of an answer to the general fear that there is a generation, you know, like the teenagers now, we're growing a generation of incredibly anxious kids and incredible, you know, and we should be worried for their mental health. And there is, I'm sure that's right. But her take on it was, this is the generation that's going to save the planet, because we didn't. We all got told that there was a hole in the ozone layer, and we did sweet fuck all, but we stopped using fly spray. And we're leaving it up to them, and they are freaking out and they are panicking, but probably to change you need that level of energy.
Yeah. And that's what Greta keeps saying as well.
I don't
want your hope. I don't want your optimism. I want you to panic, because we need to. Which is very much not in line with Waveney's general course. I don't want to take us wicked off course for the usual podcast tone, just because she's not here. To sort of round off, like, and in that vein as well of trying to be a bit positive with the recommended courses of change for people, and to be specific, you've been doing this a long time. You've associated with a lot of different groups. You've advocated for Greenpeace and for Safe and other organisations. You've met all these people all around the world who are trying to make change. Could you give the people listening something specific that they could do? Because that's what we try to do each episode, is some small thing that they might be able to take on board. And it could be a specific action point, or it could be like a slightly wider tonal thing. But what is one thing you would like to leave people with who are listening to this?
Well, 10 years ago, I would have said, do what you can. Like, look at every aspect of your life and look at what you can change. And that can, and look at what's manageable within your life, but then look at something that maybe might be a little bit more difficult and try and change that too. Because we can't sort of just meander along in a comfortable way anymore. So again, it's I think part of the problem is that don't you wag your finger at me and tell me how to live my life. That's fine. It's like we now have all the information. We do have it. It's out there. We know that, you know, the science is telling us a thing. And it's pretty much indisputable, except by the Flat Earth Society and other mental people. So make the choice your own. I think that's it, is that don't sit back and be told what you... Hi, puppy. Don't sit back and be told what you should be doing by other people, because that'll just piss you off. Make the choice yourself so you get informed. You read, you know, just read something. Find out and empower yourself with those choices, because one thing I do know is that it feels really great when you do. It doesn't feel good to be told what to do. It doesn't feel good to be told that you're living the wrong life and that you're an asshole for doing that. It really feels good when you take that power back and just, I mean, even down to, fuck it, I'm just not going to eat Doritos anymore. That's it, you know, you do that and then you move on. You go, actually, I'm not going to buy anything with palm oil in it anymore. Actually, I can do without beef. Can I do without? No, I can't really do it. Yeah, I can do without. I'll eat beef once a fortnight. You know, it's... And if it remains in your front brain, if it's just something that you stay conscious of always, it's almost like giving yourself a filter that you then look through. That you look through when you're looking at anything in the world. That was a really great sentence. Sorry.
I know what you mean, though.
But you know what I mean?
I feel like that's what happened with me, is that almost by osmosis, because I had for a long time been thinking about these things without taking any action, and then suddenly, and it'll be different for every person, there's a little thing that'll just tip you over the edge.
Yeah.
If you make the decision to just decide to give a shit and listen a little bit, and read a couple of articles, listen to a podcast, it rattles around in your brain for a while, and then you'll see one thing, I think, that speaks to you, and you go, shit, all right, well, I guess, fuck, I can't have palm oil anymore.
Yeah.
I guess I should try and cut down on the number of flights I do,
And who wants it? Or I'm going to, I mean, you know, the lovely one that, I'm sure it was maybe it was the David Attenborough, the latest one, the Our Planet series that he's just done, which is so extraordinary, you know, it's so amazing. And I'm pretty sure it was in there where he gave a figure of, I don't know how, if a certain number of trillion trees were planted overnight, we could pretty much nail climate change. So I'm like, how great! let's just go plant that. Let's plant trees. I mean, I really want. I'm searching at the moment because I want the boys and I to get involved in a tree planting. And because that, you know,
you can get paid for it. Apparently, they can't find enough.
Well, I've been watching. I've watched a few podcasts of what they're doing around the world in Indonesia and Africa and how positive it is for a community. I mean, that's something truly lovely that you can do, even if you just decide to go and plant a couple more trees in your backyard, you know. And well, for instance, my car's falling to pieces. I've got one of the oldest hybrids on the planet.
What have you got?
A Toyota Prius, but it's the
like
old
the first gen.
The first gen. And the window, you know, the window's fallen off a couple of times. And I was in a car yard. I found myself in a car yard going, I need a new car. And then I put those filters back on again. I was like, why do I need a new car? I don't need a new car. What do I need a new car for? It just gets us around when I need it to get it. You know, I don't, what's this? Why do I need a second bathroom?
Yeah.
Why do I, you know, just quietly questioning.
Well, we've been, because that sounds quite revolutionary and almost a bit brainwashy, but I think it's because, and we talked about this briefly once before on this podcast, but I reckon we've been brainwashed the whole time since birth to not question that, to go, you know, you get a new car if you can afford it. You get a new bathroom if you can afford it. Like, get more stuff, always. Yeah. More stuff.
More. Yeah. And in fact, you know, it never made anyone happy.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
No.
It's very unnecessary.
I mean, we are the most, you know, depressed, medicated, unhealthy, you know.
We've got more stuff than any generation before us, and we're probably the least happy.
Yeah, that's
that have
right.
Ever walked the earth.
That's right. That's right. So there's a disconnect there. And if it's possible to just take a moment to, like I say, take the power back yourself. And just look at how your life is running and just slowly try some stuff out. Now, that's one side of it. I also think you got to get out in March. I think you got to get out in March. And you have to get out for the sake of this earth that we live on. We got to start banging some drums a bit more noisily. So it's a combo. And that feels great too. I mean, but then I love banging drums. Maybe some people don't.
Robin Malcolm, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Expert on everything and expert on nothing. It's been lovely to talk to you.
I think one thing that's come across for me as well is that, like we started off with saying, everyone feels like they've got this imposter syndrome. We all need to make a bit of a conscious effort to put that one side when we're actually going, you know what? Some very smart people are telling us to change. I'm okay with retransmitting the scientist message.
Me
that
too.
This is unsustainable.
That's what
I might not understand all of the methodology and graphs and how they met their findings, but I trust what that guy's saying, and I have to start being a bit more comfortable with going, you know what? We should be eating less meat, etc.
Honestly, you can't, you know, my answer always when people have said to me in the past, you're just a fucking actress, why get out of politics? And I'm like, you know what? What I know I can do is put bright, shiny lights around things. So I'm not a scientist like you. I don't know the minutiae of it all, but I read enough to know. And also, you don't actually need to read anything to know the storms.
Yeah.
The weather. Really?
We've got our best people on it. They've done the work.
Yeah.
They've figured it out.
Yeah. And we're watching it happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I would highly recommend that people follow Robin on Twitter as well. Robin Malcolm. It's just your name, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Because you retweet a lot of good campaigns and stuff.
And so I've been told by my agents that I have to have an active Instagram account. So I'm trying to do that. So I'm doing that as well.
Great.
I'm not very good at it. I just keep putting pictures of my dog up.
I do the same. I try and promote comedy shows on there and no one gives a shit, and I put one video of my dog up and everyone goes crazy.
Everyone loves it. UAC.
Yeah, everyone loves the dog.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Catch
bye.
You next week, everyone.
Bye.
Thanks again to our sponsor, All Heart NZ, who are improving the planet and the lives of Kiwis through reducing, reusing and redirecting corporate waste. Check them out at allheartnz.org.nz.